broadcasting from the Unshackled Studios in Melbourne. This is Wilmsfront, brought to you by theunshackled.net. Now here's Tim Wilms.
Hello everyone and welcome to the show. The date is Wednesday, the 15th of April, 2020. It is 7 p.m. here in Melbourne. We are live on the Wilmsfront YouTube channel. Entropy has decided it is not going to work tonight, so we'll have to do without again. Now, obviously, the most significant non-coronavirus event of the past week has been the exoneration of Catholic Cardinal George Pell by the full bench of the High Court, 7-0 on historical child sex crimes. A second jury found him guilty of in December of 2018 in the County Court of Victoria. The conviction was upheld last year in the Victorian Supreme Court of Appeal. The county court trials were conducted in secret under suppression. We only learned about the evidence of the case and that it was based on the sole testimony of the surviving supposed victim. The crime was said to have taken place in 1996 after a Sunday Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is located in eastern Melbourne. Others present on the day told the court that the Cardinal would have been out on the steps greeting parishioners after Mass, so couldn't have been at two places at once. After 404 days in Barwon Prison, George Pell spoke after his exoneration to Andrew Bolt, which aired on the Bolt Report on Sky News last night. You can follow that full interview on the Sky News YouTube channel. Bolt asked him if he thought that Victoria Police had a vendetta against him, if he was being punished for the sins of the Catholic Church over its recent history of child sexual abuse by its priests and various cover-ups. George Pell's culture war enemies at the ABC and elsewhere have been extremely effective in portraying Pell to the public as a cold and uncaring person, therefore making him an easy figure for many people to hate. But who is the real George Pell? Well, the way to find out the answer to that is speak with someone who knows the Cardinal well and has followed his legal saga throughout its entirety. John McCauley is the spokesman for the Catholic League for Civil and Religious Liberties and is my guest on tonight's Wilmsfront. As well as knowing the Cardinal personally, he was also an altar boy at St. Patrick's Cathedral in the 1990s. John, thanks for joining the show.
Great to be with you, Tim. Great to be able to speak to your audience.
Now, let's start with your Catholic upbringing, because obviously you were raised Catholic and you still are a devout Catholic. And if you watched all of the ABC coverage on the Catholic Church throughout the years, you'd believe that being raised as a Catholic boy was the worst childhood you could possibly go through. But what was such a childhood like for you?
Many of the priests and religious brothers who I came across growing up, I was initially educated by the Salesian fathers. They run schools in Oakley and Sunbury, and they have an apostolate worldwide that specifically works with vulnerable young men. So the Salesian order is an order that I had a lot of close contact with. They, like all religious institutions and all institutions across the world, have had appalling examples of individuals within those orders committing sexual abuse. But I wasn't alive to that at all. We obviously in the schoolyard would joke, and if a priest was friendly to us, we'd call him a pufter. And if a priest was nasty to us and put us on detention, we'd call him a pufter. That was a sort of ribald language that teenagers would use. That I never saw any evidence at all. I then went on to study under the Christian Brothers in North Melbourne. I had such a high regard for both of those religious orders based on the brothers and priests who educated me that I seriously spent a lot of time considering a vocation to join one of them. Yet, as you said in your introduction, I absorbed Catholicism with my mother's milk. I'm an Irish Catholic. But like most Catholics, we're exceedingly robust. The best paradigm through which to understand the Catholic Church is basically that of a very large family. I come from a large family. I'm the seventh child of Irish Catholic parents, and I just find that the Catholic Church is a very broad institution, and so it's not unsurprising that in Australia, with so many institutions, orphanages, schools, hospitals, that the Catholic Church statistically is obviously going to be very high up on the radar screen of the Royal Commission. And obviously, you know that as things have played out in the past 10 years, appalling stories of abuse have emerged. Most of them I was entirely unaware of, with a couple of exceptions. It's been an interesting time to be alive, and most certainly a very interesting time to be an Australian Catholic.
A few people in the comments have been saying that they can hear background noise in the stream. That's you've got your own large family in the background there, so I'm sure our audience can understand that. It's with all of the social distancing during the coronavirus pandemic, most of the various television and internet guests are Skyping in, and there's been some hilarious moments of family and kids coming in.
We do what we can.
Now, when did you first meet George Pell? Because I've never met him in person. I've never really heard firsthand about what he's like behind. Because we've always seen him, us lay people, through the prism of the media and television. But where did you first meet him, and what was your impression of him?
As the Auxiliary Bishop of Melbourne under Sir Frank Little, His Eminence was appointed to the parish of Mentone in the southeast of Melbourne. And I went to school nearby, so he'd come along the First Communion and confirmations. He'd always speak to the students. I remember him as the football priest because he loved talking footy. Obviously, it's part of folklore now that he tried out for Richmond. While he was a great sportsman, I think that's been stretched to credulity. But it was only when I suppose I developed an intellectual appreciation for Catholicism in my later teens that he really commanded my attention. George, obviously, a brilliant mind. He taught me patristics when I was going through college. He himself, obviously, went to Oxford University, where he has a doctorate in early church history. As a young man, I got to know him when I was, I think, all of 19 years of age. He appointed me to the Commission for Justice, Development and Peace in Melbourne. I was the youth representative, more or less, and I served, I think, a three-year term there. I then went on to study under His Eminence as a theological student, and when eventually George was translated up to Sydney, by coincidence, I moved to Sydney for work purposes. So he and I have kept up a strong rapport. I've enjoyed many meals at his home. We've had the occasional drink, and would you believe it, just quietly, he doesn't mind the occasional cigar. So he's a guy who can put his feet up and enjoy the company of people. But look, in public life, yes, he doesn't wear his sentiments on his sleeve, so he doesn't come across as the warmest character in front of camera. But there's the public George Pell that everyone likes to lionize or vilify. But he's, as you would have discovered in last night's interview, he's now an elderly gentleman. But I always had a warm affection for him, even though we'd often cross swords on minor theological and ecclesiological matters.
You mentioned that there's the difference between the public persona, or you would say, well, some might say this, the professional image that he puts on. But as I've said numerous times on this show and to other people, that has, I think, been one of his biggest weaknesses, the fact that he does come across as wooden, very robotic, and if you put it in a more negative way, comes across as cold and uncaring. And therefore, when you have these people who say that they went to Cardinal Pell with allegations of their child had been abused by some other priest, he was defensive. There was some Vatican investigator who called him sociopathic, and people who are just lay people watching the news, and that they see George Pell speak, and they hear people testify that this is how my interaction with him was like. It's easy for them to put two and two together rather than see somebody like you. And because, as, and I know that Andrew Bolt has said this in the past about the private George Pell, that seems like it's more of a stretch for the public than the negative people who say that they haven't had good interactions with him.
Look, anyone who is only an inch right of centre would be able to learn from this saga of the past 5 years. Never ever give an interview other than in a full format live interview style, because if you appear before 60 Minutes, you're going to be edited, have the life edited out of you. That's a given. So you don't stand a chance in terms of George has always obviously been a social conservative. I think he's learned that lesson belatedly, but at the same time, someone who would be working under a schedule of appointments. As such a prominent person, he'd had a very busy work life. I know his work ethic is extraordinary, and so you would want to keep some of your personal side to keep it personal. There's the public, there's the personal, and there's the private. I don't think there's that much to George, the private man. There's a lot to George, the personal man. And I think George also has always enjoyed the caricature that's been put about with respect to George, the public man. And look, he probably trades on the fact that he's so vilified by his public persona, when in fact anyone who actually has had the opportunity to meet him, including, you must remember, when many of his detractors were flown to Rome for the Royal Commission interviews, he actually had personal interactions with them. And some of them are on record of having said that he was exceedingly gracious to them. Please also remember that as soon as he was appointed Archbishop of Melbourne, His Grace immediately made it known that anyone who had been abused in any Catholic institution, of which there are so very many in Melbourne and across Victoria, that he would ensure them time in his diary to meet with them personally. And he never rejected any person who made an approach to him like that, and many of them actually found that he isn't as much of an ogre as the press had made him out to be.
You mentioned that he's a social conservative within the Catholic Church, and therefore within Australian society as whole. As you said, the Catholic Church is like one big family, and you mentioned that sort of you've crossed swords with them in the past as well. And you're right that if you're, the expression is now, if you're right, to the right of Karl Marx, so you'll be vilified by the mainstream media, taken out of context, edited, and I know exactly what you mean and why the Cardinal would be hesitant to do many sort of sit downs. I remember he did do, he abided by that rule, only do it live. He did a Q&A with Richard Dawkins, one of the most prominent atheists, which I actually thought it was quite a well-structured discussion, and they actually didn't have too much animosity between them, because I think it and this is Q&A many years back before it became feminists saying let's kill a million men.
I remember that
was back in sort of the more reasonable days. But even though he is from a particular faction within the church, and as he has his detractors in the church, and let alone society at whole, it still didn't stop his ascension up the church hierarchy. Obviously, in the 1990s, his first public role was Archbishop of Melbourne. Then he moved to Sydney, and then, of course, in Rome as everyone just refers to him as the treasurer of the Vatican, but the official position is Secretariat for the Economy.
That's right. He was the prefect for the Secretariat for the Economy. In Rome, most job titles are quite a mouthful.
Mm. So is that down to his work ethic or his theology? Why? What do you... Because I know that...
when the topic of sex allegations first came up, it's put about, and I'll leave others to confirm whether this is an apocryphal story or not. But George's long-standing housekeeper said that couldn't be the case because George is far too ambitious to be interested in sex. That actually correlated with my own impressions. I lived for some years with one of the George Pell's seminary classmates, who was able to recount many an anecdote from George Pell, the seminarian in his late teens and early 20s. And you have to give him credit. He's a consistent individual with respect to his work ethic, with regards to his incisive intellect, but also he identifies himself first and foremost as a loyal son of the church. And I think that loyalty is what became suspect. Obviously, you're going to get plenty of airtime if you appoint yourself chaplain to the ABC and start, like many a cleric has done, appearing, be it with Geraldine Doog or Sarah Ferguson, to bash the church. It makes for great copy. Sex and clergy also makes for great copy. So if you're in the business of either bashing the church, or if you're in the business of printing newspapers, your focus is obviously going to be extensively on the Catholic Church. It sells newspapers, and I'm sure the media are quite delighted, just as people hit saturation point with regards to COVID, that they've now got another big story to feed off. No better example of that than just yesterday, when a number of major outlets reported that the police were raiding the Good Shepherd Seminary in Homebush to arrest His Eminence. I immediately knew that they'd got their facts wrong because...
And I saw Louise Milligan. She actually tweeted that before it was confirmed that they were investigating social media death threats against the Cardinal, she went into, there's actually interstate allegations as well. She tweeted that before the reports came through about what it was actually about.
When in fact the rector of the Good Shepherd Seminary in Homebush had called the police in to deal with the death threats. Interestingly, it would be very unlikely that rector would have tipped off the media to be there. The New South Wales police are almost as good in the dark arts of media tip-offs than the Victorian police. And so clearly the media were there to capture that footage. But the behaviour and the overreach of the left in the course of the past few days only serves to prove just what His Eminence has been up against for the past 20 years. And so I was a bit disappointed when the Dean of the St. Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne, which was vandalised and graffitied, set about to cover up evidence of a crime only 6 days ago. The vandalism on the doors of St. Patrick's Cathedral should have remained writ large for all to see the depth of animosity, the satanic inversion of the cross of Easter being graffitied all over the doors. That degree of hatred needs to remain up. So if you want to talk about cover-ups at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne, don't look back to December of 1996, look back as recently as Easter Sunday.
Do you think that they'll catch the perpetrators of that vandalism?
The church has no competence or appetite to pursue retaliatory legal measures. If the police have any material to work with, they'd be welcome to feed off it. But I doubt the church has learned the importance of having a little bit more CCTV footage around, because if there was CCTV cameras available in 1996, none of this would have come about, because it would have clearly shown His Eminence, as I knew him very often to do, to be standing there at the footsteps of St. Patrick's Cathedral for a good 20 minutes, meeting and greeting anyone who's prepared to come up and say g'day. I actually found it a bit bizarre that he'd literally wait until the last pest was pestering about some small matter with respect to unpaid primary school fees, and His Eminence would sit there and hear them out. And literally, he and Monsignor Charles Portelli would remain there until no one else wanted to chat, and George would then complete the recession back to St. Patrick's sacristy. So, look, I know how the cathedral operates, and I'd be very surprised if the current dean had much of an appetite. The church has obviously been beaten into a corner, and sadly, the Catholic leadership keep playing from the same tropes from the same playbook, which is just to roll over and be walked over. Now, I don't share that approach to Christianity. I do think those who are stronger have an obligation to defend the weak. But unfortunately, the church is largely, its upper echelons have been populated by Quislings who don't have the acumen nor the character nor the backbone to defend either the institution or the laity, and on occasion have attempted to defend the indefensible, for which I think they should pay handsomely.
The reason why that this scrutiny and investigation of George Pell has brewed for nearly 25 years is because, he began his priesthood career in the city of Ballarat, which we know through the Royal Commission was probably the worst hotspot for pedophile priests in the entire nation.
I've got to stop you, and I will actually stop you right there. Let's just recast that final sentence. Ballarat was the second least worst in terms of the statistics provided by the Royal Commission itself. I think the Jesuit order was the very lowest on the list. But again, that's pro rata statistics. Ballarat was thickly populated by every religious order you could imagine. Every presbytery didn't have just a sole parish priest. It had a multitude of curates. Ballarat is Catholic heartland around Australia. And so statistically, the Royal Commission's own stats paint precisely the opposite picture that you yourself have imbibed. So do take that into account. The case of Jared Ridsdale has been amplified and repeated in all of its horror over and over and over and over again through the years, as have other cases of clergy and religious from religious orders and the diocese. But pro rata, in fact, the statistics paint the obverse of what's the received wisdom.
Oh, I'm glad you corrected me there.
It's neither here nor there. The inaction of Bishop Mulkerns, who I met on a number of occasions, is appalling. At the same time, you have to appreciate that material came up through the course of investigations whereby the police themselves, having been approached by claimants, then approached Bishop Mulkerns and said, "We've received this person. We've told them to go and see you. Can you please get this sorted and get it fixed?" So it's hard to imagine, with all of the resourcing that the Victorian police had to call upon, that Bishop Mulkerns could think that he could do a better job when it was clearly outside both his competence and jurisdiction with regards to what you generally call constabulary or investigative operations. And so he did naive and tragic things, such as sending Father Liddesdale off for treatment in the United States and hoping that somehow or another the sickness of pedophilia could be somehow removed from such a demented mind. But again, the terms of the Royal Commission, its terms of reference, were into religious institutions. And the moment the material came up that was clearly damning of the Victorian and other police forces, the Royal Commission, it was beyond their remit to look into it. It was beyond their remit to make recommendations with regards to abuse in state institutions and state schools. Now, there'd been a lot of clamour for the Catholic Church to be shut down, for our schools to be expropriated. Well, if you're actually going to be consistent, you'd be claiming and demanding that the public school system would be shut down, and perhaps every institution should be paying commensurate amounts of compensation, at which point, obviously, the public purse could bear it no more. The agenda is very much to send, as has happened in the United States, a number of dioceses into bankruptcy, and they'll probably achieve that. But I'm not quite sure that it's condign with a reality that sexual abuse is something that has to be eradicated from all institutions.
Well, you're right that obviously the Catholic Church has received the most focus and scrutiny on child sexual abuse.
And so it should, because it holds itself to a higher standard.
But you're also right in the fact that other institutions of society, there's still rampant sexual abuse going on. There's still the lingering question of Hollywood's pedophile culture. It's commonly referred to as pedowood. There's still unanswered questions about Jeffrey Epstein and his high profile associates. But you're right, the fact that the Catholic Church, it is a moral institution, that's why it is scrutinized, but also because it is by the far left and the Marxists who've hated organized religion for a century, and they see the Catholic Church as the most powerful organized religion, that they're going to scrutinize that the most.
The scrutiny is welcome. The Catholic Church has nothing to fear from the truth. We're more than happy, as Archbishop Powell did in 1996, to open up the records to scrutiny, for which reason he instituted the Melbourne Response into Sexual Abuse within months of being installed as Archbishop of Melbourne. So I think he actually got he jumped the shark on this one. He was probably 15 years ahead of the other institutions, the state, and now the federal redress scheme. In dollar terms, the compensation that the federal redress scheme that's come out of the Royal Commission is offering, and I'm loath to use the word generous given the gravity of the nature of sexual abuse and its impact on individuals. But in dollar terms, $50,000 then was worth a hell of a lot more than what the federal redress scheme is now offering. George ensured that it was arm's length. He appointed Peter O'Callaghan, QC, a widely respected jurist, to lead that up and to make its recommendations. I, in fact, appeared before it and was grilled with him as an opportunity witness with respect to one priest who was also falsely accused. So His Eminence really did get ahead of the eight ball on this. And so, as he said in last night's interview, there's a certain irony that it's him who's ended up becoming the scapegoat. I'm fairly sure that what triggered that was what I witnessed at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne it wouldn't have been as early as 96, perhaps 98, 99, when the Rainbow Sash Brigade, as they were known, would turn up representing the gay and lesbian lobby in Melbourne with their sash across their chest, demanding communion, that they demand to be incorporated into the Catholic Church. And His Eminence has no problem with gays and lesbians. It can't many people amongst his friends who are gay and lesbian. But he did have issue with them demanding communion at a very sacred moment in the church's service. And so naturally, he'd have a chat with them there, a very awkward chat, being an altar server. It was within earshot of me. And he said, look, I just can't give you communion if you're choosing this as a time to make a protest in a Catholic cathedral, but I can offer you a blessing. And of course, they, you know, in some instances would accept it, in other instances they'd turn tail. But George, as a pastor, was always very warm. But that's what triggered him as becoming the lightning rod. And I think the gay and lesbian lobby have been exceedingly effective in trying to make as much of a storm about him. Upon his appointment as Archbishop of Sydney, that question came up in his very initial press conference with Cardinal, sitting alongside his predecessor, Cardinal Clancy, and George just quipped in reply, well, look, don't go expecting me to sponsor a float at Sydney's Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras. So he dispatched that particular concern quite graciously, but immediately, obviously upon his appointment even to Sydney, that was proof perfect the degree to which, as a social conservative, he's always been a marked man. And in the end, they secured their scalp.
And it's, you raise an important point there, that it's not that he is outspoken on his own. The media, in that situation, they baited him about it. And the rainbow sash communion stunt, which you should call it, reminds me of, well, the contemporary one, which is going to Christian bakeries, wanting a gay wedding cake so you can file a human rights anti-discrimination complaint against them.
Yeah, it's again, we're getting a little bit tired of their playbook, but until there's pushback against it, you will only be walked over. And my experience, even in recent days, reading the press release from the Vatican and the press release from Archbishop Mark Potteridge, president of the Bishops' Conference, is that the hierarchy in Australia will only ever default to the Dan Andrews line, which is, I see you, I hear you, I believe you. The problem is, I would suggest anyone even vaguely acquainted with not just jurisprudence, but human nature, would realise that that's just ushering in a deep and dark prospect of prima facie attempts to use not guilt by association, but guilt by accusation. That if you want to destroy your political enemy, all you need to do is to make an accusation against them. If I was to use rhetorically even your forum here to say that Premier Dan Andrews had abused me, should we apply his dictum immediately back to him? Dan, are you going to believe me, see me, and hear me in my accusation against you? Clearly, the logic behind that is as credible as him issuing a press release on the day of the High Court acquittal, saying he wouldn't be commenting on that matter, when that's precisely what he did. The man has no intellectual integrity whatsoever. And I think when the next election comes around, Victorians should question his political integrity.
As you said, that to put it in more, I would say, contemporary terms, Pell's the charges against him, the trial and conviction, it had all the hallmarks of a Me Too case, because it was basically a he said, he said, which is, that's not how our legal system is supposed to work. There was no corroborating evidence during the trial, and it was also.
I have to stop you right there, Tim. That's precisely how the Victorian legal system works. First of all, you get to collect $75,000 from the Melbourne response as compensation from the church. You can then go on to collect a similar amount from what was the crimes compensation scheme that was running through the 90s and early noughties in Victoria, and would now come under the redress scheme. There's also no need to have any corroborating evidence. I don't have a particular problem with the fact many crimes are committed without witnesses. But His Eminence had 24 exculpatory alibis that presented and whose credibility was not challenged by the court. So there is, in fact, a few aspects endemic to the Victorian legal systems that means that you or any one of your viewers could themselves be targeted unless assiduously they kept a diary of their every movement and everyone who ever came in contact with them, and God willing, they have CCTV footage following their every footstep. That, I think, paints a picture of a totalitarian state. But that's precisely what's required if you don't have the $6 million to defend yourself through a committal hearing, through a mistrial, a retrial, a Supreme Court appeal, and a High Court appeal. So next time any of your audience members step into an elevator with only one other person, be prepared to step out of that same elevator with your reputation in ashes, because the burden of proof has been inverted in Victoria. And for as long as Anne Ferguson and Chris Maxwell, the Chief Justice of the Victorian Supreme Court and the President of the Supreme Court, remain in their positions, then the system in Victoria remains deeply compromised. They wrote their majority judgment having read the minority judgment of Mark Weinberg. Nobody in their right mind could synoptically go through both of those judgments and think that there could be any integrity on the part of two people who wouldn't use one as a countervailing influence or a corrective to the other. The fact that the President of the Court of Appeal and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, having read their colleague's minority decision, proceeded to submit their own majority decision suggests to me there is no integrity. If you look at their backgrounds, Chris Maxwell, former president of Liberty Victoria, a well-known left-leaning advocacy group. Anne Ferguson, I think her background was in insolvency law. These are people who are now at the pinnacle, the apex of the Victorian legal system. So all of your viewers better have about $6 million. And if you don't have an Andrew Bolt behind you, if you don't have a whole team of people to support you, you're going to be spending 6 years being in the Melbourne Remand Centre or down in Barwon Prison. So there's something deeply wrong with the Victorian legal system. A modest improvement would be that, yes, I think complainants do deserve the right to anonymity, but in exercising that right, wouldn't Victorians also suggest that that right be extended to the accused? So if as an accuser, I want my criminal history, I want my psychological history, I want my history of perjury never to go before the jury, then in exchange, I think the accused has a prerogative to have his own identity suppressed until a duly constituted tribunal, or a jury of 12 peers tried and true, make a determination of guilt rather than the presumption of innocence. So I just encourage all of your listeners to consider the urgent changes that are needed if they want to avoid a totalitarian state. And so with respect to the Me Too movement, I don't think you'll achieve pushback unless there's that reciprocity at law by which the accused can have that the same anonymity as the accuser. And now, we now live in a very different landscape to a decade ago. Google searching somebody's name, somebody who's been doxxed, as is now often, so often the common tactic of the left, can do extraordinary damage to your prospects to ever secure a job or pay off a mortgage and raise a family. You'll be a destroyed man. So I think as a basic and urgent necessity, that reciprocity of anonymity is probably the best thing that could be brought in Victoria. But at the same time, you know, people who have suffered sexual abuse do deserve that anonymity, but I just think it should be reciprocated.
Well, it looks like Victoria is going in the opposite direction, because it was announced just a few days after the High Court verdict that they were introducing a Victorian government reform of sexual assault cases where the judge will not be required to give directions to the jury that consider the possibility that the witness, the person making the complaint, is unreliable or lying, which the timing of that seemed such a coincidence.
Yes, a bit of a track record. Attorney General Jill Hennessy, I think it was perhaps the day after I attended His Eminence's judgment. I sat through large sections of the mistrial and then the trial. She realised that this is obviously going to be a ticking bomb of an issue with so high profile an individual having been found guilty. So she went on that following day to brief a journalist from The Age on the prospect of bench-only trials. Now, there was nothing else going on in the media or political cycle. There had been a recommendation, I think, from the Law Reform Commission for the government to consider that, and that's what she addressed the following day in her briefing to The Age journalist. I think Attorney General Jill Hennessy was on behalf of the Premier and his Victorian government taking out something of an insurance policy that they could fall back on. But look, as it's played out in recent days, from what I can see, the left is just doubling down. They're going on the offensive. They think that that tactic's going to keep working for them because it's paid enormous dividends in the course of this saga, when in fact, I think you and an intelligent audience like yours would recognise that the greatest weakness of the left is their overreach. They've really exposed their belly, and it's now time for us to double down and push back against them, in large part because if you don't push back, they will just keep walking over you. And obviously, Christians are easy pickings. The tendency is to err on the side of pacifism, and pacifism is an error. It is actually considered a Christian heresy. If you look at the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons by Augustine, that set them up for a fall, because when the Vikings came through 7 centuries later, they were amazed that they found no resistance to their aggression, and thus the Norman invasion took over. Nothing's changed with respect to Christianity. It does err on the side of pacifism. So if you're those amongst your audience who have more of a regard for a muscular Christianity, may not be Christians themselves, I would just like them to assess this situation, see what's going on for what it is, and become part of a necessary pushback.
I think that I know Christians who do indulge in too much pacifism, and I'd say forgiveness when it is not deserved. So I think they should heed your message there.
Look, it's always appropriate to forgive. It's always appropriate for an individual to turn the other cheek. But the moment a weaker person is being offended against by an aggressor, then you have an obligation to defend the innocent. Unfortunately, it's going to be very hard for the Catholic Church to be seen to be doing that, because our current brain drain means that our current leadership are fairly enfeebled men, and we really lack the ability to push back. But for those of your audience who aren't Catholics, rest assured that my organisation, the Catholic League, is prepared to work with anyone who's recognises that we are ushering in a totalitarian state, and Victoria seems to be leading the charge under Premier Daniels. Daniel Andrews, we need to push back against them, because that's the only language they understand. They will keep marching over you and destroying every institution that stands in their way until they receive that pushback.
Port Film Cole has asked in the chat, why do you think two juries found Mr. Pell guilty? That's not true. There was the hung jury, And the second jury found him unanimously guilty, and then says only a panel of elite judges found him innocent. I just want to, because I've already picked out the flaws in that question, the two, were they like the two jury trials, were they completely new? Like, did all the evidence and the cross-examination of the witnesses, did that all have to happen again? Because that would have been incredibly time-consuming.
It was, because I attended large parts of both. Look, in deference to your audience member who's putting the question, it was put about that the first jury only had, say, one holdout juror. There's no way of knowing along what lines a jury is split. It remains forever, and it's appropriate that the deliberations of a jury remain forever unknown. That's how you protect the very important institution of a jury. And that institution is, in fact, there to curtail the overreach of the state. So I'm a great supporter of jury decisions. In this case, I sat and eyeballed every one of those jurors in both trials. I came to a very different assessment than Cardinal Pell and his legal team and his other companions in the courtroom. I was just there in my own capacity. But I was pretty sure that they were going to find him guilty based on apprehended bias. I work in industry. I know what the conversations around the water cooler sound like. I just know how entrenched the anti-Pell, the anti-clerical, the anti-Catholic and the anti-conservative bias has been in Victoria for 20 years. Look, they were, to be quite honest, they looked like sort of people who worked hard, probably lived in Melbourne's outer suburbs, typical Aussies. I think both of them were split, six men and six women from memory. But I was very, very concerned about the mind of the jury. And I was less surprised than in His Eminence when the second jury went against him. I don't think he or Robert Richter understands just the depth of anti-Catholic animus that's existed. We shouldn't be surprised. Like, all of us are profoundly influenced by our surrounds, by the media and the messaging that we've been exposed to. And obviously, the Catholic Church has endured 20 years of being told to shut up. And I've seen some just very, very bizarre reporting. So no great surprise. The jury pool was well and truly tainted. Pell made, I think, a strategic error by not taking the stand. And I think Robert Richter's demeanour in the court smacked of a certain degree of hubris. They're the things that drive a jury. But the actual conduct of the trials themselves by Peter Kidd, the chief judge, was in fact superb. His directions to the jury were straight out of the bench book. I have a very high regard for the trial judge. But there's no way any high-profile individual in an age of social media and under the shadow, the dark shadow of the Me Too movement, should be exposed to a jury trial. Victoria urgently needs to introduce the option of bench-only or judge-only trials, and they need to play catch-up. It used to be the case that trials like this would be shifted to interstate. Obviously, it's immaterial now that we all imbibe the same national media stream. So nothing would have been achieved by sending Pell's trial interstate. And there was no option. I think Victoria is the only state that doesn't give the accused the option of a bench-only trial. But with so hated a figure, a conservative, a Catholic, a cleric, a pro-lifer, an anti-gay marriage individual, a Vatican treasurer, come on, Pell didn't stand a chance. And I think he was excessively confident in the strength of his case and the implausibility of the accusations against him, that he didn't want to go too hard against his accuser, lest he be seen to be nasty pasty, with a strategic error for which he paid for 404 nights of his life, most of which was spent in solitary confinement.
You mentioned there about how even with you were alluding to the fact that the two trials were done under suppression order, and obviously the courtroom itself, it would have been packed with press. And when the suppression order was lifted, when the trial of the second charge, the pool incident, as it's referred to, fell over. We saw there how there were some of the victims of Catholic sexual abuse who developed quite general anti-Catholic Church feeling, heckling him outside of court. To me, and when he was found guilty by that jury in December 2018, it was reported overseas, but not in Australia. And of course, we live in the social media age. I'm somebody who believes in both an open legal system and also open reporting. If we're going to apply the public's right to know to politicians, it should apply to the legal system as well. And I think this whole thing about that a juror might be influenced, I think that as long as they listen to the direction, they should listen to the directions of the judge not to consume media and that. I think that it's completely pointless now, these type of suppression orders, when there's all these whispering going around on the web which can't crack down on at all.
True, and that's why I think there's sadly a need for bench-only trials of high-profile individuals. It was quite interesting seeing, and I think if not the second trial, it could have been the sentencing. That would have been the second trial. Melbourne University Press awarded Louise Milligan an award. And while I was sitting there in the court, I think one of the clerks came out and slipped Chief Judge Peter Kidd a paper with the details of that. The court went into recess. He came out, sat perhaps 15 minutes later, and excoriated the Melbourne University Press. He demanded that it be immediately withdrawn. It was already being recycled through Twitter. And he then had to instruct the jury basically not to turn on their internet when they got home that night. So Melbourne University Press, like the Victorian Police and the ABC, were really making surgical incisions into this process. We once lamented the fact that the ABC and the mainstream legacy media would be influencing, not reporting on, but influencing political events, which, yeah, is lamentable. Now, especially in Victoria, the mainstream media and especially the ABC are actually influencing judicial process and judicial outcomes. That is alarming, to say the least, not even to address the topic of the ABC's charter and its complete lack of professional ethics. So, yeah, alarming days. If you're permanently based in Victoria, it's well worth delving into the detail of this case, because you guys have a lot of rebuilding to do. If ever any of you find yourself in the dock, or being subjected to those type of, again, what I described earlier, not guilt by just association, but guilt by accusation. And anyone who's been doxxed can know just how big an impact it can be on you. I think the left are actually quite proud of what they've achieved. The process has been the punishment. They know that this has destroyed Cardinal Pell's contribution to the Church Universal, even if he is fully exonerated, even if Witness J was to confirm the reasons why he asked to withdraw from the case. I still think the left would be quite happy that the process became the punishment. They have no regard for justice, but one day they themselves might find that the tables are turned, and I'd be the first to defend them and the presumption of innocence that they too deserve.
A nebula proto star is said. Is John saying all Pels accusers are liars? That's a dangerous path to accuse sexual abuse victims of lying just because of the status of the accused.
Okay. Let's unpack that one. What are the options? If I was to make an accusation, the event obviously either happened or it didn't happen. I suppose you might have some wiggle room in the middle that I was mistaken or deluded, or that I myself was being manipulated, and in fact I got my facts wrong. When you talk about all of Powell's accusers, I think strongly encourage you to read through the very best that the Victorian police could try and pin on Powell, and that's what came up in the committal proceedings. Some of the accusers and their accusations were so wide of the mark. For instance, giving very specific details by which it emerged that His Eminence wasn't even in the country within 18 months either side of the event that they chose to affix their claim to. So the other accusers you speak of, I haven't seen anything other than Witness J's accusations, which were themselves pretty weak, but they probably just passed muster in terms of being able to be committed to trial, which is what Magistrate Belinda Wallington did. But if anyone has any accusations about His Eminence, not just with respect to sexual abuse, but anyone has any material that would suggest that he even covered up abuse, that's a highly actionable material. And in fact, not only is it an indictable offence itself not to report abuse, it's also an offence not to report knowledge of a cover-up of sexual abuse. Victoria labours under mandatory reporting. So if anyone has any actionable material, you've had 20 years to put it forward, and of course you'd have every resource of the state backing it to the hilt. Nothing stuck, and nothing stuck because George Pell is as conscientious as any of us with respect to the task of rooting out sexual abuse perpetrated upon the vulnerable. So please put forward this material, but stop using in a very censorious way this prospect that there are other charges, there are other material. Nothing has stood up to the most precursory examination. Basic fact-checking should have even saved the Victorian police about $20 million in pursuing this Witness J case.
You mentioned that the left are very proud of what they've done to George Pell, and they seem to have no regrets despite the High Court's exoneration of him, and they respect the legal process when they get the decision that they want, but when it goes against them, they say that the system is broken, and they were still out there saying that, oh, it was a technicality. They still felt at perfect liberty to call him a pedophile, but they said that, oh, even if he wasn't guilty of that, he is guilty of other things, and if he's locked up for that, that's justification for us. And they've tried to, as you said, have him convicted by guilt by association, because they go to his time in Ballarat and say, how could he not know? He lived with Jared Ridsdale for a period of time. He walked to court with Jared Ridsdale. He was Archbishop of Melbourne when all these cases were beginning to be exposed, the Catholic Church child sexual abuse that was getting widespread publicity. And so they said, well, there must be they say the probabilities are, which of course is not how a legal system works, is that he's done something wrong along the way.
I find myself caught. I think there's some visceral need for justice in our time to be done. We know that appalling things have been perpetrated upon the most vulnerable in our community, and we want justice, and we want it now. And I think a lot of educated people. I spoke to a lot of members of the bar, a lot of lawyers in William Street and barristers and chambers said, look, I actually know from everything that I've seen and examined that he's innocent, but I still think he should be behind bars. So you have to look into, well, how is it that a civilised, educated Victorian would be prepared to trash all of the great things that the Western tradition has delivered with regards to our jurisprudence? And look, maybe I, for instance, think that every cleric in the Melbourne Archdiocese should have spent 40 days wearing sackcloth and ashes in reparation for the sins of certain colleagues. So I think, as a Christian, I obviously have a very different approach, whereby I'm absolutely certain that each individual, for every offence, will be justly punished. The Christian God is often touted to be perfectly merciful, but he's also perfectly just. The Catholic doctrine of purgatory has been greatly ridiculed, but literally Catholics believe that for every misdeed in this life, you are justly punished. I wouldn't be prepared to believe in a God who would let these things go through to keep it. It was very interesting in the ABC, Sarah Ferguson's recent foray on this matter. She interviewed, I think it was Ridsdale, and obviously made hay out of the fact that he believed that God could forgive him. But I think it needs to be understood within the Christian context is that forgiveness can never be effective. I can't go to confession and be absolved of a sin unless I've actually expressed and achieved perfect contrition. I also need to make amends, and I will also have to suffer time in purgatory for it. So Catholics, I think, have a longer view of the process of justice. I think that's also what largely got us into trouble in the first place, because that doesn't meet or match adequately the demands of complete and utter and perfect justice here and now. There's no way in which the church can adequately respond to the chaos of an adult turning and abusing the innocence of a child. I just find it curious that nobody's ever quoted the very words of Christ in the scripture, by which he very clearly articulates that anyone who dare put a hand, a scandalous hand against a child, would be better that they never be born, or that they have a millstone tied around their neck and be sunk to the bottom of the sea. That's a basic check and balance that the founder of the Catholic Church put into Catholicism to caution anyone against abusing a child. And so it's very much been not just criminal acts, but it's been an abject violation of the very basis of Christian identity, which is found in the gospel.
You were outside Barwon Prison when the High Court delivered its verdict, and even though we're supposedly under lockdown, there were all the news helicopters around, and in fact, I think it was Channel 7, they followed him all the way from his road trip to Sydney, even filming him at a servo. You were on the ground there. What was the sort of pandemonium like?
I knew nearly all of the faces in the pack of media, because so many of us have sat together in the media pool at the county court and then the Supreme Court, and then 5 weeks prior at the High Court. So we're all the usual suspects. It was interesting the degree of cooperation between the police and the media. We were tipped off as to exactly what point Solicitor Paul Galbally's Mercedes would emerge with Cardinal Powell's, I think it was a RAV4, behind him. The word got out, and we were all prepared for those grabs that the world media was feeding off. It was obviously interesting that the international media, who'd been there for large parts of the trial and appeal, were absent because of the COVID lockdown. But yeah, there was a bit of a feeding frenzy. Clearly, the journalists had been appointed by their editors to report the matter. From my personal dealings with them, all had a deep-seated animus against Powell. I was there because I was accredited by CNA in Washington, D.C., doing some work with overseas...
CNA, who are they?
Catholic News Agency.
And so they report, because there's countless Catholic publications, both online, broadcast, and printed.
Yeah, but it wouldn't get any dissemination outside of Catholic circles. But you know, obviously, in terms of international coverage, that was one way of getting the story out abroad. But unfortunately, it's just a case the suppression order was described as Powell exerting his influence to have all of the tawdry details not revealed through the media. Now, I can tell you from chatting with him in the breaks from the courtroom, he would have done anything to have that suppression order never put in place, because all of the exculpatory evidence that could have been disseminated through the course of a Lindy Chamberlain-esque court case, which didn't have a suppression order, could have been consumed by the general public. And I think we'd be in a very, very different position than we are now. Unfortunately, over the course of many months, it was all under a suppression order. And so the only detail that emerged was the very day he was convicted, at which point it was all bad news for Powell and his team. And the full story, I just can't imagine. But your audience member who sent through that question, do they have the appetite to actually read through the primary details, the transcripts and the like? If you don't, then I'd probably suggest you don't be too quick to draw too many conclusions based on what you've imbibed from the mainstream media, because I worked alongside the main reporters and I know just how much they had a deep misunderstanding, basically, on even how the Catholic Church is structured. There's this preposterous idea that somehow or another, as Cardinal George Powell was head of the Catholic Church in Australia. It doesn't work like that. There are something like 28 Catholic churches in Australia. Every diocese is an entirely separate and discrete entity, where effectively your local rural bishop is a pope within his own diocese. So very strange ideas that are generally born out of a complete misunderstanding of how the Catholic Church operates, or rather one that's been informed more by Hollywood than ecclesiology. But I don't think I'm going to change any hearts and minds with respect to that. Haters will always hate, and the Catholic Church will always stand out as a fairly unique institution, and that itself generates all sorts of conjecture, and that's just par for the course.
I just want to focus on, you mentioned the fact that there was the suppression order throughout the entire trial. Therefore, when the details and the evidence came out, it was after he was convicted. And so we were basically the general public going through the facts of the case, seeing whether the institutions had got it right. And in the... because we weren't going through that process with the evidence being reported as it was, we were sort of hoping that, well, because we weren't in the courtroom, that you want the institutions to get it right. And we had obviously the Victorian Court of Appeal. They upheld the conviction, then it's quashed by the High Court of Australia, and it's as you've put there, there's something seriously wrong in Victoria. There was that this all happened in secret. We had to assess after the fact, and then we learnt out later that they got it wrong with this secret trial.
Yes. Again, an improvement to the system would have been where the defendant could ask that there not be a suppression order, especially in the case of high-profile defendants. It would have been hugely in Cardinal Powell's favour if there wasn't a suppression order, but he didn't have the prerogative of waiving or asking for that. Interestingly, the media themselves were given the opportunity to contest the suppression order and never did.
Oh.
So when there were some breaches of that suppression order, Chief Judge Peter Kidd was very, very, he really did go on the attack, and I think there were still legal proceedings in play that relate to breaches of that order. It's also very interesting, the PR manager of the Victorian County Court actually issued warning notices to overseas outlets that asserted a jurisdiction of the court beyond Australia. No such jurisdiction exists. And for a legal officer of the county court to be engaging in such skullduggery is alarming. But again, every institution in Victoria has been profoundly undermined. And if we as citizens have a right not just for justice to be done, but for justice to be seen to be done, then the situation in your and my home state is alarming, and there needs to be a root and branch review. I did notice there was a call, not just for that, but for the resignation of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court made today by former Premier Jeff Kennett. I think that's entirely appropriate. I think Anne Ferguson should just do that as a tenet of basic accountability, as should Chris Maxwell. They should both immediately resign. But I also think it's appropriate for there to be a Royal Commission, one perhaps instigated by the Governor himself, because confidence in the institutions of the state no longer exists when your executive and judicial branch are so deeply compromised. That's the point at which you should be very grateful that the reserve powers rest with the Governor. So perhaps it would be unique in Australia's history, but now's the time in the with the Lawyer X scandal in the background, now's the time for a genuine Royal Commission to be instigated.
Yeah, because it's twice in the space of a year that the High Court has basically scolded the Victorian legal system and its institutions with the Lawyer X High Court decision. There is a Royal Commission into that. I heard a Liberal MLC, Bernie Finn, who is himself a Catholic, said that I actually don't support a Royal Commission into the Pell prosecution because I don't trust the process, given that it would be done by
the terms of reference would be written by Daniel Andrews in much the same way that Julia Gillard chose to write the terms of reference to the Royal Commission, which only looked at religious institutions. If we were genuinely interested in eradicating the curse, the blight of sexual offences against minors in this country, then why wasn't every institution opened up to review, not just the Catholic Church, given that it has been the organisation through the course of Australian history that has had the most schools, the most charities, the most orphanages, the most hospitals, the most universities. That's what Catholics do. We're builders and we're not wreckers. And yet we're paying the price for our hard work over many years in building up these institutions. But clearly each of them has had a very sad side with respect to the offences by people that His Eminence described last night as offending in the name of the church. I think that was a bit of overblown hyperbole on his part, but nevertheless, these offences should never have occurred, and I think the need for redress and justice remains, and I think all of us should keep up the fight to make sure that the Australia which I enjoyed as a young Catholic, where I never had the slightest concerns, knowing and being influenced by many good nuns, the sisters, the brothers, the priests, I had the highest regard for them and for their integrity. Unfortunately, the good news story of the vast majority has been completely destroyed by the bad apples and the inability of the hierarchy to deal with the problem to the exacting and high standards that should be expected of followers of Christ.
Let's talk about the Andrew Bolt interview with George Pell that aired on Sky News last night. It was recorded last Saturday, where, as we established at the beginning, we saw a much more raw and you would say more, showed a humility that we haven't really seen from George Pell in his public appearances there. And I think that it did him the world of good to have that demeanor with Andrew Bolt be reflective in that. And as he responded to one of Andrew Bolt's questions, he's like, there's no point in being angry. He felt that sort of, well, you know him, but it looks like he's just sort of had enough of the culture wars. He just wants to sort of, he's 78, he just wants to just sort of enjoy his final years.
And I had a delightful oil on canvas in my home. It was painted by a prisoner, a hardened con at Pentridge prison in Coburg. That was a gift by that prisoner to the then Father George Powell. It ended up in his seminary in Clayton, and it ended up at my place when nobody else wanted it. It's a delightful oil on canvas of St. Sebastian painted by a prisoner. I'm giving you this anecdote because His Eminence has always been someone who would visit the sick, he would visit the imprisoned, he'd say masses in prison. He's always someone who in Sydney worked in a homeless shelter every week. Every year when it was his birthday, he'd throw on a afternoon tea and a barbie for all the people who lived at or were fed at this homeless shelter. When I was a theological student walking from Parade College in Victoria, Parade East Melbourne back to our residence, I'd often see him emerging from one of the many hospitals around there, visiting patients. And this is while he was Archbishop of Melbourne with extraordinary local and international obligations. He was always on many committees. So George has always been a deeply pastoral man, but a basic tenet of Christian identity is humility. He's not going to be engaging in any pride activities. But it was interesting, the character references from Tony Abbott and John Howard got a lot of media attention. Go through the other seven, fascinating material available online of people who worked with George in of those hidden ministries that he had an enormous attachment to, his work with drug addicts, his establishment in Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, at the Mary McKillop Centre for people suffering the affliction of heroin or ice addiction, and the like. And George himself would turn up and have a chat and a cup of tea, and wouldn't do so in an ad hoc way. He genuinely is a great relationship builder. And so there's just an extraordinary irony that one of the genuine good guys has been so easily framed and torn down, and you know, enduring damage has been done. He'll wear that, but at the same time, I think it does reflect more upon us as a society than it does upon George Pell, the very affable individual.
The only time I did get defensive during the interview was when, and Andrew Bolt admitted this, the very crass question about, did you think about killing yourself, which, of course, Pell said, of course, it never crossed my mind, because obviously that's a grave sin in Christianity.
But... I think technically we call it a mortal sin where there aren't mitigating circumstances, but I thought that was a very strange question. I wasn't at all surprised by George's... horror just at the very question. I questioned George once over dinner at his home in Kew as to whether he had ever entertained doubts about the faith, and he pointed out that old Latin maxim that 1,000 uncertainties don't make for a single doubt, and that's completely in line with an intellectual grasp of Catholicism. But George also has a very effective prayer life. I remember often seeing him praying in the back of his cathedral in Sydney, popping in on Vespers, even seeing him in prayer for extended periods at his seminary chapel in Drummond Street, Carlton. George has an interior life, and I think he should be given the latitude to have an intimate relationship with his Lord and Maker at a remove from the fact that he's always been on the battle lines, given that it's not just the Catholic Church that has finds itself split between modernism and an attachment to tradition, but our very society in Australia and our civilization in the West is also now finds itself on the precipice of an enormous chasm, and I can't see what will bridge that chasm. It's these are very interesting times, but I certainly appreciate the opportunity this evening to offer a few personal reflections on my experience of George Pell and my first-hand experience of his trial. Most of what your audience would have been exposed to is the reporting on reporting of reports. It's been a privilege to spend some time with you, Tim, and your audience. And if anyone wants to follow the work I do, you'll be hearing more and more about the Catholic League for Civil and Religious Liberties, as we have an enormous amount of work to do to stop the appalling defamation that continues, the hate campaign, the incitement that Catholics are now having to endure as part of the received culture. It's effectively anti-Catholicism is the only fashionable variety of what was once anti-Semitism. I don't quite see how it is that so quickly Australia's been reduced to this barbarism. And for those of you who haven't been Pell supporters or still think that justice hasn't been served, I just encourage you to be open-minded and to drill down into the primary sources, and I think you'll find that a lot of the conspiracy theories don't hold water, and you yourself might find yourself in hot water if you found yourself on the end of guilt by accusation. So I ideally hope that Australia will emerge from this having learnt a few very important lessons.
Well, that's the hope, certainly, but there, especially in Victoria, there doesn't look like there'll be too much that will change. But I've appreciated your insight and experience. You've it's taken you a lifetime to observe and learned the inner workings of the church that I'd have no hope of cramming in a week. There is just one more point. We've got to go to Dia Beltran live next, but it's clear that George Pell is not going back to be the treasurer of the Vatican. There has been a lot of commentary that he was exposing and cleaning up a lot of the financial corruption within the Catholic Church, because there's been a lot of reports over the years of Catholic finances and the mafia connection and the what a term the bling priest there, and he's there's some unfinished business that he didn't get around to basically quashing. Would you say that that's another area of the Catholic Church that, like the child sexual abuse, the finances, making sure that they're above board, moral, like you said, that's reined in, tightened up.
In terms of modern accounting standards, one of the greatest tragedies is that the first Pope, St. Peter, happened to die and be buried in Rome. The point I'm making is that Italian accounting standards are rather elastic compared to what the major audit firms in Australia or the West would expect. And His Eminence was just applying Australian standards of due diligence to the typical Romanità, the Italian way of dealing with these things. I think that would have been quite a shock. It's not unprecedented. The office within the Vatican that hands out passes for visitors and major events was for, I think, 40 years run by an Australian Christian brother, a Marist brother, if I'm not mistaken, partly because he wasn't given to corruption or nepotism, and those passes were never handed out other than in a fair-handed way. So bringing an Australian into that role was always going to shake things up, partly because when it comes to probity, Australians are recognised as having very high standards. I actually don't buy a lot of the conspiracy theories, and I think I got a bit of a sense from the interview yesterday that George was backpedalling a little bit from some of the conspiracy theories regarding Vatican finances. The Vatican's budget runs to about $300 million a year. It's all available and visible. I think their current auditors are Ernst & Young, and the vast majority of it goes to very mundane administrative matters and making sure that the poorer parts of the church receive funds from wealthier parts of the church. And George made his contribution. He's 78 years of age. He'll still, I hope, continue making a contribution to the universal church around the world. He'll be very effective at that. He still has a very sharp mind. I know he has the self-discipline not to provide a running commentary on the church here in Australia, but I wouldn't be surprised if I next run into George Powell at David's Place, which is a shelter in inner city Sydney, where all of his friends at that homeless shelter will be missing him, and I'm sure they themselves will probably host a barbecue when His Eminence is freed up to be able to get back to doing the things that he likes, which is visiting the sick, comforting the dejected, and spending time with the homeless. That's the George I've always known. It's the guy I admire. I just hope he can see out the sunset years of his life with a degree of satisfaction. As a student of history at Oxford University, curiously enough, His Eminence has ended up writing himself into history. I can assure you the name George Powell will be known and talked about for many generations here in Australia.
That sounds like an ideal way for him to go forward. And we have to remember that as in charge of the finances of the Vatican, he was appointed by Pope Francis, and obviously they in the ideological factions of the church quite at odds. And during the interview last night, he said, "Yes, I was frank with Pope Frank." Pardon the pun. There was this mutual admiration for each other. And we also have to remember that one of his strongest public defenders throughout the appeals process was Father Frank Brennan, a Jesuit priest like Pope Francis is. I crassly call the Jesuit priest the SJW faction of the Catholic Church. But it shows there that even though there are these differences, they still, well, they want to see due process. Frank Brennan, he followed the case almost as to the letter.
And bear in mind, of course, Frank's father was the Chief Justice of the High Court for many years. So when I looked across the courtroom 5 weeks ago, I felt for Father Frank Brennan, who must have sat there watching his father's deliberate and hand down verdicts. It must have been really coming full circle, given that the son of a High Court Justice has himself become a Catholic priest. Obviously, you know, a strong exponent of many leftist positions. But please understand, the Church doesn't have an ideology or a philosophy. At the end of the day, Catholics are only asked to sign up to faith and morals, and we're allowed to fight on everything else that falls outside of revelation, which we describe as faith and morals. And we're a fairly robust family. My experience is one of, there's a seventh kid in my family, is a natural thing to be part of the Catholic family is you have a few punch up on the things that don't matter, but on the things that matter, there's plenty of agreement. But yeah, we're exceedingly robust, and the Church and Cardinal Cole have nothing to fear from the truth.
Oh, we've gone probably longer than both of us expected, but I think we've been both very thorough, especially yourself, John. So thank you again. And yeah, well, I'll definitely link in the show notes page to the Catholic League, and that's where people can see well they're not just your plans for Catholic civil rights League, but also other people who are working to defend the faith. I think I've lost John there, but
no, I'm still here. Just wanted to thank you for the time, and also point out that my Facebook page has always been public. So if you want to have a crack at me, then just go onto my Facebook page. My surname McCauley is spelled with three A's. But that's the best place to get in touch with me through Facebook. As I just said, I believe in robust exchange. And if anyone wants to hit me up with any hard questions, then please head to my Facebook page, and I'm more than happy to engage you there.
I'll put that link there as well. And yes, I did spell your name right. It appears on the screen here. So if they just search the name on the screen, they'll be able to find you on Facebook.
Cheers, mate. Really appreciate your time and the time of your audience. Thanks for lending me your ear.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good night. And that's the show for tonight. We've gone over 8:30 p.m. Melbourne time. I won't hold the audience here for much longer. I'll see you all again for The Uncuckables tomorrow night, 8:30 p.m. Melbourne time on The Uncuckables YouTube channel. Hopefully you can get Entropy working. And of course, keep checking out theunshackled.net for our latest news and commentary and the Unshackled Productions archive. So have a good night, everybody. And tune in to DRL Trend Live, chatting with Stephen R. about Orthodox Christianity. So a religious-themed night here on the Australian Alt Media lineup.
Thanks for tuning in to Wilmsfront. Visit timwilms.com or Rational Rise TV to view the archive of episodes. And keep visiting theunshackled.net to view all our shows. And to keep up with the latest real news and analysis.